your flesh and blood.
And we are indeed here to understand. Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. A little different opening for the first day of January, the first day of 2011. Let's not jump the gun here. I'm Richard Dugan, your host, and we come your way every Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m. Pacific time. And today is no exception, as well as starting off the year with what I like to call a bang, a Braden bang. It's Greg Braden on the line, and we're going to be talking not only about fractal time, we're going to be talking about just a myriad of different things, whether it's surrounding 2012 or just the evolution of man. And Greg Braden, it's great to have you on the program for this very first day of the new year.
Richard, I am thrilled to be on the program. It's great to hear your voice. I'm going to say happy 2011 to you and all of our listeners. This is the first program for you in the new year. It's the first program for me as well. So I'm honored to be your first.
Well, you know, there are a lot of firsts that are taking place for people. They're experiencing some things in their lives that they've never experienced before. In some instances, you could label it frustration or being perplexed. Some people are actually in awe of some events that are happening in their lives that have never happened before. And there are those who will attribute all of that whole conglomeration of experiences, to the transition that we as the human race are going through here on planet Earth, whether you want to tie it to 2012 and the Mayan calendar. As a matter of fact, in December of 2010, on December 21st, we had not only a full moon, we also had a lunar eclipse. We were in the midst of, from an astrological standpoint, Mercury in retrograde, and I've had guests on talking about those kinds of things. But you've written this book. It's been around now for, what, about a year or so, called Fractal Time?
Yes. Well, Fractal Time was released in hardback in 2009, and it was released in paperback in the spring of 2010.
And there's one question I have not asked you in regards to that book, and every time I get to the end of the interview, I'm going, why didn't I ask him this?
You should call me back.
I should have. Fractal Time. Where did that concept, that title come from? I know PR firms, they'll create a title and you're going, well, that's not what my book is about. But that seems to fit. Would you explain that concept?
Well, absolutely. The term fractal time is a union of two accepted principles that are validated by science in our world today, and the leap, if you will, that was made through the book Fractal Time is the combining of two principles into a way of seeing the world that is very different than what we've seen in the past. The first principle is certainly the principle of cycles. Almost universally, our indigenous ancestors of the past and today, beyond the Western technological mind, the indigenous way, the ancient way of seeing our world and our lives is in terms of cycles, Richard.
Mm-hmm.
Whether we're in the highlands of central China and Tibet, or we're in the monasteries of Bolivia and Peru, or I live in northern New Mexico, right here in our own backyard in the desert southwest, the indigenous peoples have always seen our universe, the cosmos, our world, and our lives in terms of cycles. And some of those cycles are obvious cycles, such as day and night and the lunar cycles of the month. Some of the cycles cover vast periods of time that no one living at the beginning of the cycle is alive to see at the end. But the idea of cycles permeates our worldview in the ancient and the indigenous traditions. It's only our modern world that has kind of veered away from seeing a cyclic perspective of life into a linear perspective, and we'll explore what that means in just a moment. So the idea of cycles is key here, and the principle of fractals as a relatively new idea was actually the idea of fractal patterns was discovered, and the term was coined in the 1980s when Benoit Mandelbrot, a very famous mathematician, actually just passed away this last year, discovered that as complex as nature appears to be in the world around us, all the patterns and shapes in nature that we see, when we reduce those patterns and shapes down to their individual constituents, what we find is that nature is actually made of just a very few patterns that repeat themselves again and again on different levels of magnitude, different scales. So, for example, when we look at the pattern of an atom that we can't even see with the naked eye, there's a pattern there of a nucleus, the core of the atom, and things moving around that nucleus, the electrons, anywhere from one to many, many electrons moving around that atom. And or the core, the nucleus. And I remember when I was in school, Richard, I remember looking at my science textbook at the one of only two full-page color pictures in the whole book. The rest of the book was a very dull black and white. And seeing a picture of an atom and thinking to myself, you know, except for the size, that atom looks a whole lot like the moons moving around the planet in our solar system, like Saturn or Jupiter. You know, they have like 13, 14 moons moving around the planet. And except for the size, that atom looks a whole lot like the solar system itself, like the planets moving around the sun. And this is precisely the idea of a fractal. They are the same patterns, the same pattern that allows the electrons to move around the nucleus of an atom or allowing the planets to move around the sun and, mm-hmm. and our sun to move around the core of our Milky Way galaxy. And our galaxy is moving around the core that the ancients called the great central sun of our entire universe.
Yeah.
So they're different levels of magnitude, different scales, but it's the same pattern. And the beauty of a fractal pattern is simply this. If we understand the principles that allow that pattern to work on one level. For example, if we understand the principles that allow electrons to move around the nucleus of an atom, then that gives us insight into the way that pattern works on every other level. Mm-hmm. So it gives us insight into why planets stay in their orbits and move around the sun, or why our sun stays in its orbit and moves around the core of our Milky Way galaxy. So it's these two principles, the principle of fractals and the principles of cycles, that are known and accepted in science. And the leap that fractal time took was to marry these together and apply them to time itself. And I know you wanted to ask a question. I want to respect that.
Well, first of all, I've seen computer-generated fractals, wonderful spirals. I've got this giant poster, and it's like that was when I first heard about them, was probably in the mid to late 1990s when I was first introduced to this concept of computer-generated fractals, which to me was fascinating. I mean, I loved them. They're just fabulous. But what you're talking about in terms of from the micro to the macro, I've been thinking about that for as long as I've been on the planet. It's like it just made sense to me that if you had, if the universe was made in the way that it has been made to operate, it only stood to reason. I mean, I've seen the science. I went to science class. I don't know how much I retained, but I went to it and I saw the big dioramas or the big displays with the spinning nucleuses and atoms and so forth around them. I saw those and then I said, well, wait a minute, but those look like the planet spinning around a sun, or as you began to expound, as far as the universe is concerned. And I'm thinking, well, if that's the case, if there's a similarity from the micro to the macro, then when I started talking about computers, when they became of age, I said, well, but the computer is just a basic design of the human brain. And somebody said to me, oh, no, it's not. And I said, well, I realize the computer doesn't have emotions. As far as we know, I mean, depending upon how you feel about different manufacturers, computers tend to do sometimes what they want to do. It'll reboot or what have you.
Sure.
But I saw those similarities. And so what you're telling me is very familiar to me. I'm wondering, is this something that has been with you maybe as long as you've been here? I mean, is this a concept that was not foreign to you, even if it was introduced to you through your engineering days, or even into the days that you're working now in the last 10 or 15 years with all of the incredible work that you've put out?
Well, thanks for that, Richard. And I think for most people, not just for myself, intuitively, this makes perfect sense. Intuitively, we see these relationships between these patterns. There was a documentary on one of the science channels, one of the cable science channels that was on late in 2010. And it was fascinating. They on the screen of the television, they placed two images side by side without putting a label underneath to tell what the images were.
Mm-hmm.
And they were so very, very similar that the documentary led us to believe we were looking at two samples of the same stuff, when in reality the picture on the left was a picture of the neural network, the nerves of a human brain, and the web-like network that those nerves form, and the picture on the right was the web formed by the light of galaxies in the universe and the web that they form. And it's this principle of fractals all over again.
That, wow.
The pattern of the way energy moves in our brain, for all intents and purposes, it appears visually. It's the same pattern as the way light and energy are moving through the cosmos. And, just a sidebar here. Right in the last month of 2010, NASA released a new study that they thought was curiously interesting, and my sense is that it is actually very telling of our relationship to the cosmos. What they were doing is they're using new satellite data. Well, we have new satellites,
mm-hmm.
and from those new satellites, the data is inviting us to recalculate the number of stars in the universe as we know it.
Yeah.
Not the galaxy, but the whole universe.
Yeah, I heard about this study. Yeah, it's fascinating.
Yeah, well, actually, it tripled the number of stars in the universe, and the scientist that reported it, he said, isn't that curious that if you take the number of humans on planet Earth and the number of cells within each human, which is about 50 trillion cells per human, that's the average,
yeah.
And you do the math, that the number of living cells on our planet is uncannily close to the number of stars that now are believed to exist in the universe as we know it today. And they said, isn't that an interesting curiosity?
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, well, it's those curiosities that lead us into the exploration. It tells us that that we're part of, rather than separate from,
yeah.
our world and our universe, and that this concept of fractals, as above, so below, the little patterns repeating on the bigger scale,
mm-hmm.
it's probably playing out in magnitudes that we're only beginning to really comprehend. But coming back to fractal time and the fractal patterns,
mm-hmm.
these are two accepted principles in science. The idea that a few simple patterns, they're called self-similar patterns is the term scientists use, repeat themselves on different scales to fill the space of the universe, if you will. That is an accepted principle. And the idea of cycles in certain natural rhythms, that certainly is accepted. What I did was I began viewing time from the perspective of fractal cycles, because time is a function of nature. It's not something that we necessarily have created, although there's a lot of controversy around how real time actually is.
Right.
If time is a natural phenomenon, then it should bear out the principles of nature as we know them, and cycles are part of those principles, fractals are part of those principles. So the bottom line is I applied those principles to cycles of time to help us look at specific events that have already occurred in our past and give us insight into when we can expect the conditions of those events to repeat in the present and in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And in doing so, to give us the edge, Richard, where rather than speculate, for example, on all of the fear and the predictions and prophecies of 2012, what can we realistically expect? Because 2012 is part of the cycle. The cycles have occurred in the past. If we know where to look in the past, we don't know exactly the events that will occur, but we have an idea of the general conditions that we can expect to be present. And what we found, and what the book actually describes, is 2012 is only one application of understanding cycles of time, fractal cycles. We can use it for any event in the past, any event. We can identify the time in the past, the date, for example, that was the first time an event occurred. That's called the seed. S-E-E-D, the seed event.
Mm-hmm.
Once we know the seed, then we can apply the mathematics, very simple mathematics of the natural laws and the natural rhythms, to tell us when we can reasonably and realistically expect those conditions to repeat again on a global, on a cosmic level, but we can also do it in our personal lives for things like hurt and loss and betrayal, or good things, success, abundance, the good things that have happened in our lives as well. So when we begin to apply these to the world as we know it today, what we find is everything from cycles of war and peace to economic gains, economic collapse, cycles of disease and the way they spread in the world, they all appear to follow these natural rhythms if we have the wisdom to recognize them.
Now, is it a fair jump in logic, using what you've shared with us thus far, and I'm going to take this to a childhood story written by a gentleman by the name of Dr. Seuss. And the story is Horton Hears a Who. Now, if, as you've described, from the micro to the macro, the cycles, the fractals, if you will, exist, then is it really that far-fetched a concept to believe that just as the 50 trillion cells of our bodies make up the physical body, is it not inconceivable that on that micro level, that those cells spinning around, the neutrons, the electrons, the protons, et cetera, we could say, okay, and those are the planets. One of those is going to be the sun or the star, and then you have all of these things circling. Isn't it possibly conceivable, using that logic, going down microscopically, that there couldn't be living beings such as ourselves there? Now we go to the macro. We're sitting on a planet which is actually an electron, proton, neutron, nucleus, what have you, and there's our sun, that's the star, and that we are nothing more than one of the 50 trillion cells of another being that's much larger than us. And for that matter, not even going there, staying at our level, other beings that exist out in the rest of the universe. I mean, it is kind of arrogant of us to think that we're the only ones here in this vastness.
Well, you just asked three questions, and the short answer is yes, probably.
Okay.
And you know what you're describing is actually not that far-fetched from where evolutionary biologists say that we are now, and where we're headed is that we are essentially here on Earth part of a living organism that we call the cosmos. Mm-hmm. It's a very, very different way for the Western mind, certainly, to think about our relationship to the world. It's not so different from the way the indigenous peoples of today view our relationship to cosmos, and certainly the way our ancestors, our ancient and indigenous ancestors, viewed our relationship to the cosmos, that we are part of a living system that is undergoing a metamorphosis. And if you want to stay with that theme, a dear brother and spiritual brother and colleague of mine, a dear friend, Dr. Bruce Lipton, you may have had on this program in the past, actually talks about this topic from a biological perspective. And then he gives a beautiful example that our listeners may have heard of before, but it's in the metamorphosis of a caterpillar into a butterfly. And what happens is in the cocoon that the caterpillar weaves around itself, so there's a life form of a caterpillar that is discrete, it's functional, it has its life form, and then it weaves the cocoon and begins to degenerate. To us, it looks like that caterpillar is degenerating essentially into a soup. It is an undefined mass of cells inside this cocoon, but there are a few cells that biologists actually call imaginal cells, I-M-A-G-I-N-A-L, imaginal cells. And those imaginal cells in this soup, they begin to do something that the other cells have yet to do. And those cells begin to take on a new form and perform new functions. And as they do it, they set the pattern. They lay the foundation for other cells to follow suit. And what follows is when all the other cells essentially fall into line and do what the imaginal cells begin to do, a new, more evolved life form emerges, and that is the butterfly as we know it. But it begins with the imaginal cells essentially learning to be and to live a new way in their environment. And if we take that metaphor to another degree into our world today, the metaphor is simply this, that we have a complex society. We have a life form that's existed for, that began about 5,000 years ago, according to conventional history. Mm-hmm. Civilization began about 5,000 years ago. We've reached a point now where we're going into a metamorphosis. And from the chaos and the breakdown, the soup of our metamorphosis, all the things that are breaking that are no longer sustainable, from the way we solve our problems through war to economic systems to traditional medical models, all these things that are breaking down now, there are new ideas that are emerging, and those can be likened to the imaginal cells of the caterpillar. And some of those new ideas are probably better than other ideas. And when we embrace a set or a series of these new ideas, it's those ideas of sustainable ways of living, not primitive, but sustainable ways of, mm-hmm. of growing our food and of caring for one another and caring for ourselves and creating the energy on this planet that allows people to live and communicate the way they do. Those are the things that will allow this planetary body then to emerge into something new.
You know,
I think it's a powerful metaphor. It's a beautiful metaphor for exactly what we're talking about.
It really is. And it actually leads me into the next question. It sounds to me, Greg, like we are moving forward from the old paradigm, the old dualistic paradigm, to a unified paradigm. That it's not black and white, day and night, up, down. Even what we hear from the ancient religions and the wisdom teachings is that we are all one, that we are all part of the collective, if you will, and on and on. Whereas many of the more modern teachings are of God and the devil. There's good and bad. And as you have described the universe, as we've been talking here, there hasn't been that dualism. All you've talked about is the unity therein, whether it's from the micro to the macro or back down again. It's all part of everything.
Well, it has to be, because without those polarities, we don't have the experience. And the polarities are a fundamental part of our reality as we know it today. You cannot have electricity, for example. You can't have light mm-hmm. without having pluses and minuses. It all comes down to pluses and minuses, and the polarity, whether we're talking about an electrical charge or male and female or light and dark or up and down or left and right or good or bad or, child or adult, however we want to look at these things, the polarity world, it's the tension of the polarity world in the space and the time mm-hmm. of our experience that allows our experience to be what it is. And if that polarity goes away, I'm not sure even how we would define what it is that we live in today, but it would look very, very different from the world that we have today.
Sure, but by the same token, it seems to me that we're starting, even if it's just in the infancy stages, to move away from the polarity concept, the dualism
absolutely.
In that respect. And
absolutely. I think from the perspective of the way we solve our problems, I think that is absolutely true. And this is, I think, where fractal time really can be a valuable tool, because we are living what many people consider this time where the world essentially is falling apart, is the way many people see it. Well, it's easy to see it that way because the systems that are familiar to us are no longer working the way we are accustomed to them working, on the one hand. And on the other hand, if we step back and look at the big picture, what we find is the only things that are breaking are the things that are no longer sustainable in our lives, the systems that are no longer sustainable under the stress of a world that is changing quicker than anyone imagined that the world would change. Within a single generation, we're going through this enormous change.
Yeah.
Now, from the perspective of cycles, if we, in fact, are living in a cyclic universe, then this change should be nothing new. It has probably happened before. And the key, into giving ourselves a realistic idea of what we can reasonably expect is to pinpoint the places in the past where this has happened. And through the calculations that are now possible and the understandings of fractal time, we can do that. When I wrote the book, Richard, one of the first things I found was that my readers didn't like to see math in the pages of their of their book, even simple. These are very, very simple mathematics. This isn't complex math that you need, you know, a big calculator or a big computer to run. But they didn't like the math, so I moved it to the appendix, a lot of people didn't even like it in the appendix. And so what I did was I automated the calculations that are possible through our understandings of fractal time, and I put them onto a website. It's available, gregbraden.com. There's no fee or charge or anything. The explanation is there with a very friendly, user-friendly interface. And I tried to make it just look like a calculator you hold in your hand. It's a handheld calculator.
Right.
And when we answer a couple of very easy questions, we enter the length of time of the cycle that we're exploring, for example. This is a world age cycle that we're living in, 5,125 years. And when we use the different modalities in the calculator, it allows us to go forward or backward in time with cycles. So when we plug in 2012, for example, and we use a mode number 2 on the calculator, it allows us to look backward in time at another time when the seeds or the conditions for what we're experiencing were planted. And it's interesting, because one of those cycles lands in Egypt. I believe it's the end of the 18th or the 20th dynasty. I'm not sure exactly which one, but the conditions are so similar. The world was changing. The weather changed. The climate changed. The ability to grow food changed. And the Egyptian army began looking for other countries to get their resources and food from that they needed to sustain their population. And they went about it in a competitive way rather than a cooperative way. Rather than working with these countries, they began to invade them, and they created wars. And they had multiple war fronts. So many of their soldiers, so much of their military was committed to wars. They were stretched thin. They were spread way too thin. And the money to support that effort was dwindling at home until their economy collapsed. And when the economy collapsed and one of their rulers at that time died, is when Egypt, the great civilization of Egypt that had been there for at least 2,500 years, that's when it collapsed into decline and began to disappear. And the similarities between what happened then and what happened now are they're profound.
Mm-hmm.
And we find this almost universally. Much of my adult life, Richard, has been dedicated to exploring the places in the world that have been least disturbed by modern civilization, to understand what they may have known that we've forgotten about our relationship to the world and our time in history. And one of the things that has come to light is that we are not the first advanced civilization living on this earth. Our history books tell us, our children in school right now, when you and I went to school, tell us that civilization is linear, that civilization began about 5,000 years ago with, it's actually in the biblical era, 3,000 BC, with primitive, you know, grass huts living near water, and then we gradually moved inland, and we evolved till we've got steel and glass skyscrapers today. Well, what we're beginning to understand is that is not the history of all civilization, that is the history of the current cycle of civilization. Mm. And before this cycle, there was another one. And before that cycle, there was another one. And each cycle lasts for approximately one of these great world age length of time, which is 5,125 years. So the current cycle began in the year 3114 BC, about 5,000 years ago. The cycle before that, it began about 10,000 years ago. The cycle before that, 15,000. Mm. And where this gets interesting is new archaeological excavations are now uncovering advanced sites of advanced civilizations that fall precisely on these 5,000-year marks. So 5,000 years ago in northern Peru, for example, just in the last 6 years, an advanced civilization has been uncovered that's older than anything in the Americas. It's older than the Mayans and the Aztecs, than the Olmec, you know, older than any of that. And it is an advanced civilization. Five massive pyramids, a great central complex, 66 acres is this site. 10,000 years ago, on the border between what is now India and Pakistan, an advanced civilization is being uncovered with hot and cold running water and geometrically laid out streets, glass in the windows, an advanced system of writing and mathematics. 15,000 years ago, on the plains of Bolivia, a site that appears to have been a seaport town that is now 12,000 feet above sea level is being excavated. And the key to all of these, and the reason I'm even sharing them now, is because it appears that at these 5,000-year intervals, when Earth goes through the physical changes that change the way we live our lives, not unlike what we're seeing today, the way people respond determines how they experience the changes. War has been implicated in each of these advanced civilizations of the past. And now we find ourselves on another 5,000-year mark, and there's this disturbing pattern that precedes us. And the question is, what will be our legacy to this 5,000-year pattern, these cycles? Will we cooperate and work together to get through the changes, or do we fight one another and make the mistakes of our past where everyone apparently loses? And we're answering that question through the choices we make right now.
And it raises a couple of very interesting points that I want to get into as we continue talking with Greg Braden, author of Fractal Time, as well as many other books. I have to say that probably one of my favorites in our conversation several years ago, a couple years ago, was the Spontaneous Healing of Belief. Just to me, that was fascinating, but that's also part of the process. And we're going to continue talking about that. I'm Richard Dugan with Greg Braden here on Tell Me Your Story. Stay tuned.
Oh, come on, walk with me. Talk with me. Tell me your stories. I'll do my very best to understand you.
Understanding, we're trying to understand all that we're being given here, not just on this program, but by all of our guests. My guest today is Greg Braden here on Tell Me Your Story, and this is the first day of a new year, and it's the first opportunity that we've had to converse with Greg at this particular point in time. We're talking, of course, about Fractal Time, his latest book. I wanted to find out from you as we ended the last segment. You raised some very interesting points, and I'm not sure whether I should feel optimistic or pessimistic if the last three or four or five cycles came to an abrupt end because those people could not get their act together. And I'm wondering if there's any evidence that you have seen or that has been uncovered showing us that there was any conscious effort on the part of those people, even if it was a minority of people, to try to change and sway or raise the consciousness. That's the current terminology in this cycle. We're trying to raise the consciousness so we don't repeat the cycles of the past. What is your perspective based upon what you've seen, what you've heard, what you know?
Well, you know, it's one of the questions I've asked myself, Richard, and the answer is, the true and clear answer is we simply don't know, because the archaeological records scientifically only allow a certain level of detail. And here's one of the great mysteries and one of the problems of these sites is, of the sites that I've just mentioned, only one of them has any written record that we recognize today. And so there are no written records that have been found in the 5,000-year-old site in Peru. There are written records in the 10,000-year-old site in between India and Pakistan. There are no written records in the 15,000-year-old advanced civilization in on the what's in the high plateau of Bolivia. The records that have been found in India and Pakistan are in a language that to this day cannot be translated. So although the records are there, we don't know what they say.
Wow.
And to me, it's just amazing that in the first years of the 21st century, there could be an ancient language that is yet to be deciphered.
You've got to find that Rosetta Stone, man. Got to find that Rosetta Stone.
Exactly. Well, this is called Indus Valley Script. And if there's anyone that would like some homework for the year 2011, translate Indus Valley Script, shoot us an email when you figure it out and let us know what they say.
We can use all the help we can get.
Absolutely. But the bottom line to what I'm sharing here is that we don't know exactly what happened. All we can do is infer from, we know that wars happen because in India and Pakistan, for example, in that site, human skeletons are all piled up in one end of the city as if they were running from something. And the what was happening that time was a war between the superpowers of the world at that time. So that's the history. Now, for today, what gives us the edge, what I like to think of as an evolutionary edge and an advantage over our ancestors and past civilizations, is number one, that we recognize the cycles, because there have been enough of them now that exist now that maybe didn't exist before. We can look at the past and we see that pattern developing, and through principles such as fractal time, we know where we are in the cycles, and we know that we are at a crisis point. The best minds of our time are telling us in no uncertain terms that humankind is facing the greatest number and the greatest magnitude of crises ever to face a single generation of recorded human history. And that these crises, any one of a number of these crises, if it goes unchecked, it can forever end civilization and possibly life as we know it. War, for example, if the wars that are brewing right now are allowed to go to fruition, these wars will be unlike any wars we've fought in the past and have the potential to fulfill some of the darkest of the prophecies and the predictions. But the flip side is also possible, because every one of those prophecies and predictions tells us there's an outcome where the war never happens, because we find a new way. The imaginal cells of human consciousness wake up and say, what are we thinking? And we initiate new cooperative models rather than the competitive models. And I am seeing this. I'm encouraged because I'm seeing this both behind the scenes in governmental and agencies and private think tanks. I'm seeing tremendous efforts to rethink the way that we've engineered our civilization and our lives. And publicly, on the big stage, I'm very encouraged by what I'm seeing, because spontaneously throughout the world, we are seeing efforts from independent producers as well as very well-known, high-level, highly placed organizations to bring large numbers of people. We're not talking about 3,000 or 5,000 or 10,000. We're talking about 100,000 plus people together at different places throughout the world to illustrate to the world through these events that there is a different way of solving our problems, and that we don't have to make the mistakes of our past. And these efforts are spontaneous, uncoordinated efforts that are just popping up throughout the world. And as they discover one another, they begin to coordinate among themselves. And these are like the imaginal cells popping up from the soup of the chaos and all the gloom and doom that we could focus on.
Right. Well,
that's why I think it's so fascinating, Richard, that both are happening at the same time.
Well, there's the dualism again that we're still working in, but we're working through it at least. I have to say that I still remember on September 11th, 2001, as I'm watching the images unfold on my TV screen, the first thought that went through my head was, we have to handle this differently. Well, and the reality is we didn't. We did not do anything different than we have done down through history. But that was the thought that went through my head. I don't know if that was intuitive or what, but I said, there's something not right here. There's something amiss. Now, I'm not going to get into any of the other stuff, but I think that people, as you say, and I think the phrase that's been real interesting that's come to my attention is that this is the first time in history that we are aware of that consciousness is now aware that it is conscious.
I believe that is precisely the case. And I worked in the defense industry as well as a number of corporations long enough before I began writing the things I'm writing now to recognize a simple truth, and that is when I see something that makes no sense to me, it's generally because I don't have all the information. And that's the way I see 9/11, mm-hmm. that you just mentioned. I don't know precisely what happened. I have a strong sense that we don't have all the information. But it's interesting you bring it up because fractal time, the cycles of time, the seed for 9/11 was actually planted. The first time America was surprised and attacked on American soil was in 1941 mm-hmm. with the attack on Pearl Harbor. And this is one of the first models that we used once the time code calculator was developed. And when we plugged in all of the information, the dates, now I do this in the book if people would like to follow it, mm-hmm. All the information around 1941, we plugged that into the time code calculator, I was amazed to see that September 11th fell precisely on the fourth iteration, the fourth fractal cycle of the conditions that were spawned from 1941. In other words, the cycle, the conditions mm-hmm. for surprise and attack on American soil that were seeded in 1941 set into motion a pattern. That pattern will repeat. The conditions of that pattern will repeat on a rhythmic basis until something changes that pattern. And September 11th fell precisely on one of those cycles. Now that it has happened, we have the opportunity to change that pattern again. Are we doing that? I believe that through very enlightened ways that I'm seeing emerge, both behind the scenes and publicly, of dealing with some of the crises happening today, I'm encouraged. I'm not saying it's done.
Right.
And I think we've still got some work to do. One of the things I wanted to share quickly, and I know I'm always aware that this this hour goes by so quickly.
It does, yes.
I was in the summer of 2010. I was doing a conference, and I was sharing information about fractal time in a large live audience. And a gentleman came up to me at the end of the program and identified himself, and he was a civilian working with a private think tank in the D.C. area, whose job it was, they were on contract with the Pentagon, and the job of this independent think tank was to identify cycles of time and cycles of events, and from those cycles determine what scenarios we are possible in our future so that we can prepare contingency plans so that we can be prepared for, you know, whatever thing might cross our paths as a nation.
Right.
So he came up to me and he had just seen the fractal time calculator, and he said, "Where did you get your math to calculate the cycles?" And I shared with him a very simple math that was done on a laptop that was on stage with me. And he said, and I asked him, I said, "Why are you asking?" And he said, "Well, he shared with me what his company does, and he said, we use very complex math on very big calculators or big computers to fill up a room. But he said, the interesting thing is we're coming out with the same cycles and the same events. And that told me that, at least in general, we're on the right path, and that he and I stay in touch, and we are looking at very similar cycles. And the value, I just want to share this, as we wind down our time here, the value of knowing when a cycle begins and when it ends is this very, very powerful yet subtle principle called a choice point. At the end of one cycle of time, whether it's a cycle that lasts 5 minutes or 5,000 years, at the end of that cycle, a window of opportunity opens that allows our choices to have a greater potency to change the pattern of the past before the cycle begins again. And the length of that window of time, how big, how long that choice point is determined by how big the cycle is. So, for example, in a cycle of 5,125 years, the Mayans identified the choice point as a 36-year window of time between 1980 and 2016. This is the Mayans identified this window. 2012 is the end of the cycle, but the window of change lasts until 2016. And the value of knowing all of this is if we know when the conditions that define our lives and our world today, if we know when they repeat, and some of the most frightening conditions of war and suffering from the past, are those cycles are actually repeating 2010, 2011, and 2012, which means that 2010, 2011, and 2012 also open the windows of opportunity that are rare and precious, Richard. These are the windows of opportunities that allow us to change those patterns of war and suffering and poverty and disease, for example, and redefine the new cycle that is about to open up and move forward. Mm. And it's this window of time. It's rare for a single generation to have so many opportunities to redefine their past as we move into these new cycles. And I think we probably all sense that on some level. We may not be able to verbalize exactly why it is, but we know something's up, and
right.
We know something very unique is happening. And I think for many people, they're stuck between the fear and the optimism. You know, which way realistically should they go? And I think we have a lot of reasons to be very optimistic right now, because, and this answers the question you asked about 5 minutes ago, because our understanding of cycles and the way these patterns repeat and the windows upon which they converge, they give us the edge that allows us to choose. So first, we have to know the cycles exist, number one. Number two, we have to know we have a choice, and we do. And number three, if we know when our choices are the most potent, then we can stack the deck in our favor, the natural deck of the cycles. Stack that deck in our favor, and that's an edge that I sense our ancestors did not have. And when they made the very bad choices that they made. And even if we don't know any of that, what the new science is showing is that the model of cooperation is truly the model in nature, not the model of competition. It is not Darwin. Darwin observed this in specific species, and then he generalized it to all of life, and that was the mistake, that cooperation rather than competition is the key to survival. And over 400 peer-reviewed scientific studies done in the late 1990s and the early 2000s now are confirming that it's not survival of the fittest when it comes to large-scale populations, that it is cooperation that determines their ability to transcend the changes.
What you talk about here is, as far as the cycles and the choice points and so forth, makes me think of not the movie Groundhog Day, although that would be an easy one for most people to pick up on. Actually, I remember seeing an old Rod Serling Twilight Zone episode where a gentleman starts the scene out, standing out on the curb between the opposing parts of traffic, waiting for the light to change. And he's carrying a suitcase, dressed in a suit and tie, and he begins his day. And he goes through the cycle all the way until 11:59:59, and boom, guess where he is?
You and I must be about the same age. I saw that Twilight Zone.
Yes.
It's in black and white.
Yes. And so I sit there and I watch this. Now, the difference between that episode and, of course, Groundhog Day is this guy, there was no getting out of the loop. He was trapped in it. Whereas with Groundhog Day, you had a nice little message there that said, if I only figure out what I'm supposed to do and how I should behave and be as a real human being, I can get out of the cycle, which is, of course, what happens. And that's really where I see those choice points, is that that's the place where we can figure this out. And we're actually being given, as you just described, 3 points, 2010, 2011, and then 2012. And we have two more opportunities for to turn the corner, so to speak, and go a different direction. It's almost like we have multiple parallel lives that we get to choose. And one of those is going to be our destruction. But another one, and again, there are multiples, could be we will raise the consciousness. We will decide, you know what? Cooperation is the better way. And by the way, when we get back, could you, because you talked about this in a previous interview, and I want you to reiterate it for those who may have missed it. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story. We're talking with Greg Braden, and we will be right back.
Oh, come on, walk with me.
Going to be talking with Greg Braden here in our last 10 minutes about cooperation versus competition as we talk here on Tell Me Your Story. And his book, his latest work, available through gregbraden.com, amazon.com, at your local bookstores, is called Fractal Time. On that study that you were talking about in a previous program where they were studying cooperation versus competition.
There have been, to date, at least 400 peer-reviewed studies, as we mentioned before the break, where biologists, evolutionary biologists, are examining the role of competition in a number of different species in terms of their success and their ability to transcend changes in their environment, changes in their lives. And the question was asked, what is the optimum amount of competition between species? And this isn't, the friendly competition of, a soccer game between two countries or anything. This is violent competition is what the studies were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the studies came back with exactly the same number, and the number was zero. 0% is the percentage of how much competition enhances and ensures the survivability of a species. Every time, it was 100% of cooperation that assured the survivability of families to meet changes in their environment, survive the number of living offspring when we were talking about animal species. And this is news for a lot of people, and actually upsetting.
Yeah.
To people who've invested their lives, entire textbooks and college courses are created. Our civilization is built on the idea that everything is separate from everything else and that there's not enough to go around, so we've got to fight for our piece of the pie. And that model of competition now, at the end of this cycle, when we are facing the greatest challenges of 5,000 years of human history, we've got to solve those problems. And as Einstein said so brilliantly, we can't solve them by thinking the way we were that got us into the problems. And this is the choice that we must make now. We've got to embrace what the new studies are showing us and acknowledge that the way we have solved these problems in the past probably isn't going to work to get us through the challenges and the crises that we face today. And I think this is the hardest thing, Richard. It's the hardest thing to ask a generation of scientists, engineers, social architects, and just everyday people who have lived our lives under one model of civilization to, in that same generation, to embrace a completely different model telling us something differently. It's the change in the thinking, I think, is where the evolutionary leap is going to occur.
Yeah. Again, I want to thank you. It's always a pleasure having you on the program and dialoguing about these things. They're so intriguing to me, and I know to many others, and I'm hoping that it has opened a few doors for folks as well. So thank you so much for joining us.
I am as well. Richard, thank you. I want to thank you for being such a gracious host, for your dedication, your vision to creating the kind of programming in the forum like we are exploring right now, so we can have these conversations. And I look forward to another program in 2011. Thank you so much.
We will have you back probably in April or May to talk further about this, and hopefully to expound even further to, again, raise that consciousness. Greg, thanks once again. And until next Saturday, love to all.